Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
Quiet, numbskulls. I'm broadcasting.
Can we get serious now?
One thing that did happen during the 60s was some music of an unusual or experimental nature did get recorded and did get released. Now look at who the executives were in those companies at those times. Not hip young guys. These were cigar-chomping old guys who looked at the product that came and said, I don't know. Who knows what it is? Record it, stick it out of it, sells, all right. We were better off with those guys than we are now with the supposedly hip young executives who are making the decisions of what people should see and hear in the marketplace.
Success in the music business begins with a dream, a vision. This podcast will give you, the listener, the insight and tools to turn that vision into a reality. Meet the industry professionals who work day by day behind the scenes, helping to make those dreams come true. Welcome to the business side of music.
Today, we got across the table from us Jay Took, whose musical journey began in his childhood home of Weyburn, Saskatchewan.
You actually said it correctly.
I know. Isn't that scary?
Yeah.
Wow.
Everybody says Saskatchewan.
I'm actually going to have to go back and read that again. Where he cut his teeth on bass guitar, drums, guitar, and piano. Later, as a part of the burgeoning Manitoba music scene, Jay spent 15 years dividing his time between traveling the world playing and singing with Michelle Wright, Chad Brownlee, Doc Walker, Dean Brody, Jody King, and one more girl. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You just got off the road yourself lately?
I did, yeah. I was in a project called the Steelwoods. We were out, I did about 3.5 years with those guys, and just it was time to come off the road, get to know my wife a little bit again.
How long have you been on the road since the inception of being on the road?
The inception? I guess since I was 18. I'm 41 now, so whatever that math works out to.
So I'm going to assume you've been in every state, every province.
I have, except for Alaska, Hawaii, but I think I've been pretty much everywhere else.
You got to do something about that pretty soon.
Yeah,
here.
Soon enough, yeah.
Yeah. Do you like being on the road?
I do, yeah. I enjoy... I figured out very early when I was 18, I moved to Winnipeg, which is about 6 hours east of where I grew up in Saskatchewan. I hadn't really traveled a whole lot, and Weyburn is a really tiny little town, and it's the usual story of, I got to get out of this place, or I'm not, you know, that kind of thing.
Kind of the one horse town.
Yeah, that whole thing. I got into my first road band, which was a cover band. I got to get out of... and see more things that I'd ever seen growing up. And the travel bug caught me real quick. So I really enjoy being on the road. I love seeing new towns, new places, and getting to play different venues and find great restaurants. That's really half of it, is the restaurant finding.
It really is. Yeah.
You know? It's a thing that, you know, if I'm home for too long, I kind of get the itch a little bit, you know?
It's interesting you say that, because anybody that listens to the podcast knows I spent 14 years on the road touring, mm-hmm. and actually went to work for a record label to get off the road. And the very first thing they did was put me back out on the road for another 2 years. I would come home after spending, you know, 6 months on a bus or traveling by plane or van or whatever it was. And I'd be good for about a week to 10 days. And then you get that itch and you got to scratch it and you got to get back out.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I was talking about this, our guitar tech and I, we were talking like it's, if you know you don't have any dates coming up, like if you're taking a month off or whatever, you kind of settle into, okay, I've got this that I have to accomplish in that time that I'm home. But it's that thing of like, yeah, we're on a 10-day break. Like you kind of, you know, you start scratching a little bit because it's like, you know, it's coming up because you're excited to get back out there. And it's not even so much that it's the shows for me. Like I love playing live and I love doing all of that, but it really is just the adventure of getting out and seeing places you've never been before, you know, and getting to see places you've never been and eat at restaurants and just find, it's the adventure for me.
I think that seems to be a theme there.
Yeah. when my wife and I take vacations, we plan it around restaurant stops.
Yeah, well, so do my wife and I. So I know what you mean. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, when we traveled across country a year or so ago, I said, you know, there's this great restaurant. And she goes, how do you know these things?
Right.
Said, well, honey, we stopped and ate there like 20 times when I was on the road touring.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, good places. Touring is performing live. Favorite thing to do? You also produce?
I do, yeah. My ideal thing, I love being in the studio so much, as well as much as I love being on the road. And it's, so, you know, my ideal situation is to not be gone 200 days out of the year, which has been a thing the last few years. But I really, I'd like to be able to have and split my time evenly between studio and on the road, because I love locking myself in my cave, you know, once I've got something tracked and I'm mixing, or if I'm just doing overdubs by myself. Like, I love that, getting into the zone in my little room and working on every, you know, and working on the, like, there's this sort of Zen moment, you know, that you kind of put the cake dish over the bat phone, so to speak. You know what I mean? Like, it's just kind of shut the whole world out.
Those that are old enough actually know what that means.
Yes. There used to be a show called Batman, and he had a phone. And yeah, sorry. It's one or the other for me. Like, I really enjoy both equally. And I'm very fortunate that I get to do both of those things now, because I don't think I could just do one all the time.
So which of the two do you think you actually enjoy more? When you're on the road touring, do you miss producing? And when you're producing, do you miss being on the road? Is it an equal balance for you?
Well, I think maybe before I was busy enough where I had, you know, I knew if I was coming home and I didn't have a project to work on, I would try and find something to work on. Or my wife is a songwriter too, and I, you know, we would go in and demo stuff just so that I could be in there all the time. So to answer your question, I think, yeah, I would miss, if I knew I didn't have something to work on at the studio when I got home, I would have to find something to do, because I need to exercise that muscle when I have the ability to. So
let's talk about producing for a second. How did that come about? Because a lot of people are great engineers, but shouldn't be producers, and a lot of producers should never be engineers. How did that come about for you? Did you realize that that was something you wanted to do? Were you spending time in the studio and seeing other cats doing it, or?
I've been playing music since playing some sort of instrument since I was probably 5 or 6. We had a piano in the house growing up, and I would, you know, hammer away with 2 fingers, just melodies and whatever I could figure out. And I eventually decided I wanted to learn, probably when I was about 14 or 15, that I wanted to learn about recording, because I started to read up on what a producer does. And one of the producers that I really was gravitated to was Mutt Lange.
One of the best?
One of the best, because, I mean, he's incredible. So I saved up some money and I bought a Fostex 4-track. I just figured out how to use it. You know, I was 15, so this was probably 94.
Yeah, no YouTube.
Yeah, there's no, like, you know, tutorial on what does this gain knob mean and what does safe mean? You know what I mean? You know, just knowing what all that is. So I had a lot of trial and error, and I would just get cheap mics from Radio Shack with the on-off switches and hang them around my drums and just sort of figure out, you know, record myself playing to records and whatever else and figure out how to do all of that. And then once I got a little older and started playing in bands, you know, I was always the guy that, you know, I would listen to the songs and try and arrange them and sort of take on that thing. And I think I just sort of naturally fell into that role of anything that I was involved in. I always had a really hands-on approach to, if we were writing music or arranging things or whatever it was that we were doing, what that was. And then turning that into a job, when I moved to Winnipeg, I started interning with a guy named Paul James, who had done some work at Compass Point for probably 2 or 3 years. I think he'd interned down there and worked on some really amazing records and opened a studio up in Winnipeg and worked out of other rooms up there. Some really great facilities up there. And I learned how to cut to tape, you know, then that slowly got into working with Pro Tools. And then, but I was always just writing and recording with every band that I was in or whatever project that I was doing. And then I just decided, well, I want to find a band that I can work with. So I did. And I didn't play anything. And I played drums, but I found them, and I, you know, we worked from pre-production because I knew what that was and what it was supposed to do and its role in the whole thing, and just kind of worked my way down the line, and we made a record, and it turned out, and it did really well for them. And the hooks were in pretty deep at that point, because I really loved that process of working with talented musicians and talented writers and good singers, and being able to take something and sort of, you know, take these songs and make the, you know, trim the fat up a little bit and mold them into something. And then after that, I mean, it was all bets were off. Like, I just knew that's what I wanted to do as much as I could do it.
What brought you to Nashville?
I've been playing with this artist named Jody King, and I toured with her for about 2 years, and they were moving down here. They had signed a deal with Word Records. They are now called Love and the Outcome, and they're doing very well over there. It was just that time in my life, like I had really been working hard on becoming a good studio musician as best as I could. And the Winnipeg music scene breeds some of the finest musicians that I've ever played with and have worked with. Anytime that we got to be in a studio and be a band for an artist or a producer or anything that I was producing, I mean, like, we used the Nashville number system, which isn't a common thing anywhere that you go, but, you know, we would get these songs from publishing companies and stuff in Nashville through friends and connections that we had, and they would send charts, and we learned how the whole process worked. So we wanted, collectively, all of us wanted to learn how to be that good. So we worked really hard at doing that. And then it just became that thing of, it was just time. I had, Jody and Chris were coming off the road for about 6 months. They were going to write their record. And I thought, now's the time if I'm going to do it. I want to go down and see if, just see if I can cut it. It was that challenge to myself of, can you go down there and pay your rent? Basically, you know, can you eke this out? And a lot of things that I thought I knew, I didn't know, but I was always open to learning everything that I needed to know, because, you know, I'd get to sit in a room with guys that I get, you know, I'd somehow get in, called into a session, and there'd be a bass player that I'd heard on a million records who's, you know, I'd studied what they had done and why and how, and the, you know, as a, you know, where my producer brain comes in and listening to how they approach pocket and groove and all of these different things, and taking all of that information that I thought I knew into this studio or into this session, and then realizing that I really had no idea how it actually worked and how our version of that back home wasn't really how it was down here. And I learned a lot of lessons really quick in the first year that I was here. Yeah, that's the long version of how I ended up here.
We're going to take a break, get a word in for our sponsors as we come back. I want to talk a bit about the role of the record producer these days.
Yeah.
Versus especially what it used to be. It's, I think the dynamics have changed a little bit, and then let's dig into that.
Sounds good.
In the studio with us today, Jay Took, who is a drummer, bassist, guitarist, keyboard player, a little bit of everything.
A little bit.
But also a record producer.
Hi, this is Chuck Thompson with the Thompson Entertainment Group and Navigator Records, and you're listening to The Business Side of Music.
You're listening to The Business Side of Music.
Nashville Zoo comes to life at night with magical glowing animals, gigantic flower gardens, colossal Chinese figures, and a 200-foot-long dragon. It's Zooilumination, Chinese Festival of Lights. Meet Santa in a two-story holiday village with a towering Christmas tree and giant train. More than 500 lanterns spread across the zoo, making this the largest lantern event in the country. Come experience this 800-year-old tradition, Zooilumination, November 15th through February 2nd. Learn more at NashvilleZoo.org.
Hi, everyone. I'm Larry Butler, and I want to send you a free digital copy of my new book, The Singer-Songwriter Rulebook, 101 Ways to Help You Improve Your Chances of Success. That's right. Everything you need to know to launch your career as a singer-songwriter, all based on my 40 years in the live performance arena. And believe me, I've seen it all. In my book, you'll find the 10 things you have to deal with before even thinking about becoming a singer-songwriter-performer. You'll also learn about the 5 things every singer-songwriter can do this weekend to make their live show better. 5 things I can guarantee that you are not doing already. Plus, there's tips on songwriting and staging, photo and video shoots, publishing, merch, dozens of other topics, all written for people who don't particularly like to read. And again, it's free. Just go to the Business Side of Music website homepage and look for my book cover. Click on it, and a free digital copy of my book will be yours. I'm Larry Butler, and I approve of this message. Thanks.
You're listening to the Business Side of Music.
Back in the studio, Jay Took sitting across the table from us here, Nashville, Tennessee. Record producers, you know, back in the days, a lot of record labels, big budgets, they'd bring in the heavy hitters, you know, whether it was Tony Brown, Brown Bannister, whoever it was. Things have changed a lot because people have their own studios now. They're working maybe out of the bedroom of their house or converted the garage, whatever it is. We don't all have facilities like the one we're in right now doing the podcast. Mm-hmm. And the role of the producer, do you think that today's artist, especially the independent artist, do you think they have a comprehension of what that role of the producer is?
Yes and no. And I think it varies from artist to artist, really.
Do you think they have it in their mind that they need a producer?
Well, I think if they've had some experience, you know, where maybe they've made one or two records or have had a bit of a foray into recording a little bit, I think once they've had a chance to work with a producer, I think they start to see the value of it early on. Like when you're sitting down and, you know, doing pre-production and working out arrangement ideas and talking about, you know, just the overall approach to recording and how, you know, how they want their end product to come together. But it's a completely different thing nowadays because you're, in essence, like you can be the guy, you know, the development guy, because you're helping the artist figure out what it is that they want, because sometimes they don't know, especially if they're very new and young and they're coming at it at their, you know, their first time. I mean, you end up wearing a lot of hats that I don't think producers, especially the big name guys back in the day, would have to do, because he would just sort of come in and you would, you know, the material would be somewhat chosen, or sometimes that producer would come in and write with the artist or whatever, which you still do, and I still do now. I mean, it's definitely a completely different game, because recording is now so accessible to everybody, you know, and you can make a decent sounding recording for, you know, a fraction of what you could. Like, I remember paying studio rates at $350 an hour. I know guys that'll record songs for $350 for you nowadays, you know, but it really is that thing that as a producer nowadays, like the hats that you're wearing, it's a lot more of them, because you're having to guide a new artist into this whole realm where they've never been before, and they don't have an understanding of it. But I think that if you're good at your job and you pay attention to your artist and you're not trying to enforce your creative ideas and a sound that you have in your head, as opposed to what is it that they want to be and who is this artist that they want to be and what do they want to sound like, and you can do that, then I think that when, you know, the takeaway for the artist is going to be that they're thankful that they met somebody that helped them achieve that goal of what they were at, not just, well, I do this one thing and you're going to get it and that's how it's going
to
be.
The artist that goes into the studio, especially for the first time and maybe doesn't have an understanding of everything that's entailed in that recording process, how far out ahead should the producer get with that client and start laying the groundwork of what needs to be done? And what is that groundwork? You talk about pre-production. What's that entail?
Well, you know, the 4 and 5 song EP is kind of the new thing now. That's kind of the new standard. I like to get in about a month out if I can. I want to start hearing, you know, if they've got 10 or 15 songs, I want to hear what they've got and really start breaking that down for them and figuring out what the gems out of that pile are. And then out of those, really working those songs into being the best that they can be, and then sitting with the artist and just listening through recordings that they like and talking about different philosophies of how we can approach the recording process, because we can go in and, you know, depending on the style of music, really, I think that really dictates which way your pre-production is going to go too. Because if you get an artist that, you know, would sound, that's going to be like your Chris Stapletons or your Brent Cobbs or any of that, you know, these real kind of Americana artists, where the benefit of the recording comes from everybody being in the same room and getting a chance to put a band together that's going to really understand and interpret the music the way that it should be, you know, then you sit down as soon as you get your arrangements together, then you can get in a room with everybody and put it together. But if you're doing something that's maybe a little more pop music based, and it's going to be a lot more button pushing and in the computer, in the box kind of stuff, that pre-production comes from, for me, for listening to other ideas of artists that they really like and trying to find a way that they don't, so that they don't sound like everybody else. Because I don't like to just regurgitate. I'm a really big fan of trying to find the essence of what that artist wants to do and finding a really creative way to reinvent the wheel as much as you can.
Do you think that, because I get what you're saying here, originality instead of just kind of another one-note samba that, you know, I listen to radio and I go, that's just sounded like the song that they played before that.
Exactly.
Do you think there's still room for originality? Do you think, you know, the Beatles laid a lot of groundwork.
Of course.
The Stones did.
Mm-hmm.
Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson. Are there still opportunities out there for that creative mind, especially the songwriter and the producer, to develop, to come up with something new that hasn't been done?
I think that there is. And I don't, whether or not, you know, mainstream radio is going to jump on that, they will. I don't know. I mean, that's really outside of my wheelhouse. But I think that creativity is there, because you hear these artists that come out. Well, let me go back a few years. Like Eric Church's record, Chief. That record for me really changed the way that I looked at recording anybody that wanted to do sort of pop or radio-friendly country or any genre for that matter. Jay Joyce is one of those producers that, you know, he's a madman in that he's not afraid to let things get weird. And Eric is a great songwriter, obviously, but I mean, you know, I remember when that record came out, a friend of mine called me and he says, you got to come hear this thing. And we sat down and I listened to it and I was just blown away because sonically the record is all over the place. I mean, you've got singles that kind of, you know, they've got these big new rock, like Nickelback style guitar tones. But then you get into this other tune, like there's a song called Jack Daniels, and it just sounds like there's two mics in the room and Eric's singing into one of them. It really opened my eyes to the fact that as long as you've got great material, you know, and you can go, then you can approach it any way you want. And to use the Beatles as an example, I mean, I'm a huge Beatles fan. These are songs that really could have been treated any way that, you know, they could have gone a million directions with them. But I mean, the way that they chose to present the material, like when they got into Sgt. Pepper's and Abbey Road and all of those different things, I mean, it's that creativity still exists nowadays. And it's, you know, whether or not radio stations or whatnot pick that kind of thing up, there's still an avenue for those artists to find it. And I find stuff all the time where I'm just like, wow, this is nuts. But you'd never hear it on the radio, you know. But
that's another question I think that has to be asked a lot in that. And this isn't an anti-commercial radio, terrestrial radio thing. We have Sirius XM that we listen to in our car. And then, you know, our phones through the Bluetooth will just listen to, whether it's Pandora or iTunes. Is commercial radio that important? I know for every song that's out there that makes it, there's hundreds, if not thousands, of songs that don't.
Mm-hmm.
But you can still be successful without that mainstream radio. Is it important to create, and when I say create from a writing and producing standpoint, is it important to create for commercial radio, or should you stay true to yourself and just, no matter what, that's what happens?
I think at the end of the day, you have to be true to yourself. I think that you have to, you just have to, because you can hear it when it's phoned in. You can tell when, you know, you flip on the radio and you hear 10 songs in a row. You can't tell who's who anymore. You know, nobody has a sound anymore. You used to be able to hear when George Strait came on the radio, you knew it was George Strait immediately. When Garth Brooks came on the radio, Willie Nelson, anybody like that. And I think nowadays, like, you know, if you're chasing radio and you're doing that sort of, that's your career path and you have the ability to do that and make an impact on commercial radio, do it. My opinion is don't regurgitate, try and innovate, you know, do something that's different and outside and sonically has these really interesting textures to it. Because, and if you're not going to do that, I mean, there are careers that are made, you know, that you don't, maybe not, they're not household names, but you can go out and you can earn a very comfortable living doing the music that you want to do. And as long as you're true to yourself and you put the work in and you have the ethic and you have enough smarts and you happen upon some of the right opportunities, because that's always part of it, you know, you can, the cream always rises. You can always hear authenticity in what people are doing. And that, to this day, always resonates with people. Always, 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 always. First time you heard Blackbird by the Beatles, like, that, it levels you. The first, you're just like, it's beautiful because it's saying something to you, because they're not trying to do anything. They're just, that's what came out. Then that's the music that happened. It wasn't forced. It's a very natural thing for those things. And people respond to that, and people still respond to that today.
Do you think there's another, let's say, Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon out there? I mean, to me, that album, you know, along with Jimi Hendrix, Band of Gypsies,
oh yeah,
Santana, Braxis, Chicago Transit Authority, their mm-hmm. first album, those types of projects were the ones that, probably more so than the Beatles, just blew my mind. And listening to Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon album on headphones late at night with the lights out, it's mind altering, and it will change your perspective on music. And I still listen to that album. I said this a while back with Santana, Braxis. I still hear parts in there that I never heard before because I'm always listening to it differently.
Yeah, always. For me, like, I find new material based on mix engineers and producers that I love, and just sort of going through, I'll get on AllMusic and go through their discography and just start listening to stuff. And I discovered this band, I think they're from Norway, called Low Roar, and they made one of the most original sounding records I've heard in a really long time. And it's, I would put it on that caliber of, I mean, that's saying a lot. Maybe I shouldn't do that, but it's the first record I'd heard in a long time where the first song came in, and it's a friend of mine played it for me in a studio. It was like after the day of sessioning was done. It's like, you have to hear this record. And I sit back and he put it on. And I had that moment of, you know, the first time I heard Dark Side of the Moon, it was just like, you know, the sky opened up and I was inspired, you know, which doesn't happen very often anymore because of, you know, you get a lot of the same...
The complacency of it.
Exactly. And I, but there's, you know, there's bands like Wilco, which is another great band, you know, that is doing something. I mean, doing something different and interesting. You know, you get a guitar player like Nels Klein when he got into that band, like it's still, they were still this experimental thing, but, you know, he brings in a voice to that the way Gilmore does a thing with Pink Floyd. Like I can hear Nels Klein on a record a mile away, you know, the way you can hear Gilmore on anything. You can just sort of hear an inkling of a guitar solo in a grocery store.
Kind of like a Mark Knopfler.
Exactly. Same thing. I mean, the same sort of deal. And there's a lot of that music out there if you go looking for it, but it's just not as mainstream as it once was, you know? It's like that quote you have at the beginning of the podcast, Frank Zappa's talking about, you know, the freaks that made the decisions about doing things. It's like, yeah, I mean, because people don't take those risks to do it anymore. And I think it's just because people aren't used to being challenged when they listen to things anymore. Nobody's going to take the time to sit down. I mean, if, you know, a band came out and Sgt. Pepper's had never been released and they put out Sgt. Pepper's, nobody's going to sit down and listen to that. You know what I mean?
Well, the attention span has shrunk a lot, too.
It has, yeah.
We're going to take another break, get in a word for a couple of our sponsors, and come back. We're just going to keep this conversation going. Let's talk about all things production.
I love it.
All right. Jay Took is in the studio with us today.
This is Claire Ratliff with Laughing Penguin Publicity, and you're listening to The Business Side of Music.
You're listening to The Business Side of Music.
Wow, I just joined the Music Starts Here community. This is a truly hidden gem for anyone in the music business. Whether you live in Nashville or anywhere else in the world, Music Starts Here is like a GPS for your music career. This is the place to be if you want to get advice and direction from some seriously talented musical people who have been where you want to go. Music news, events, and a great big community with resources for artists, songwriters, musicians, studio and tech, along with music business advice from pros in the industry, all on one site. Make sure you get your free profile now. Go to www.musicstartshere.org. That's musicstartshere.org.
You're listening to The Business Side of Music.
Back in the studio here in Nashville, Tennessee, sitting across the table from me in the bunker here. Studio. Jay Took is with us. Great conversation. We left off, you know, talking about just the creative process of the albums, especially the ones I listened to growing up that I mentioned earlier. I remember Jimi Hendrix, Band of Gypsies, which I think they did at Fillmore East in 68 or 69, I think it was. And it was just three cats on a stage, but it sounded so full, just those three guys playing.
Mm-hmm.
And I miss that in music these days. It's out there. I know it is.
Mm-hmm.
And every once in a while, you get a little glimmer of it, and you go, oh, who is this band? I've got to follow them. And then they just kind of seem to fall off the face of the map. And then you got to go and try and find some others. And my youngest son is now into bluegrass and Americana, and he's introducing me to artists that he's listening to. Should the producer focus on one style or one genre of music, or should they make themselves well-rounded? Now, I don't think everybody can be a Jay-Z and then go in and cut, you know, a Tim McGraw project. I don't know if those waters can cross-pollinate or not.
Right, yeah. I mean, it really just depends. I mean, I always look at a guy like Rick Rubin, who did Run DMC and then did a Slayer record and then just did the new Avett Brothers record. I mean...
And oh yeah, by the way, Johnny Cash.
And then Johnny Cash, you know, and did some of the best work Johnny Cash ever did.
In fact, the industry and a lot of fans had given up on Johnny at that point in the latter part of his career.
Mm-hmm.
And then that Rick Rubin project came out and just reignited that flame.
Man, I wish I could remember the documentary. He talks about working with Johnny Cash, and he said, all I did was when we did pre-production, I hit record. And there's a video of him. It's just they're sitting in his living room, like sitting on a couch, like right over here. And it's a vocal mic and a 414 on the acoustic. And Johnny's just playing. And there's no, okay, we're rolling. It's just, it's on. And it's going all the time. And he just let him sort of find this space where he's not thinking about the fact that you're in a recording studio or you're doing anything. He's just, that all disappears. And it's like what I talked about earlier about the quote about putting the cake dish over the bat phone. You know, it's that when you find an artist like that, that has done and made so much incredible music, but you allow them to get to that place where they're not thinking about it anymore. And it's such an, it becomes such an effortless thing. That's where that, I always call it the extra 5%. Like there's really great stuff, but then what makes something really, really great, it's the extra little 5% that happens. And that's why some artists' records, I think, are better than others, is because the recording process doesn't get stagnant and it allows them to do, to sort of just shut off and play. And you get back to that point when you were a kid. Like I remember getting my first set of drums and like running, you know, for my birthday, I think I was 10, and running into the garage and just playing because that's all I cared about doing. And I think that as a producer, if you can help your artists get back to that first moment, that purest moment of music for them, of anything, I think that you're going to find, you're going to get the best thing out of them, and they're going to listen back and go, I didn't even know I could do that.
You sometimes have to pull things out of them. And in the process of doing that, maybe on that occasion or occasions, you just got to stop and take a step back and take a deep breath and go, okay, let's not focus for a second. Let's just kind of let the mind go and let it open up.
Exactly. I mean, you have to learn how to shut it all off and stop worrying about it. And I did an EP. My wife and I co-produced an EP back in, I think that was in May. A guy named Tommy Kelly. He's from Indiana. Great songwriter, great singer. We went over to Welcome to 1979 and cut to tape with the band. Tommy'd never been in a studio in his life. He'd sit at home in his room and he had a couple of mics and he would kind of do the thing and make videos and put them on YouTube. And I really wanted to do it live. I didn't want to tune anything. I didn't want to fix anything. So we went there, we cut the tape, and two takes in, Tommy was pretty nervous. He didn't know how to get his headphone mix right. And he was playing acoustic and singing and doing everything.
Not only that, that can be intimidating being in the studio because let's face it, the meter's running.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. And then just something happened, like we were upstairs and he heard, and he just needed to hear himself back once. And we went up and listened and he's like, oh. And it was just like this happened. And he nailed it. We did 2 days. We took a bunch of time and did 5 songs. And for the type of music that it is, I mean, there's some experimental elements of it. So, you know, we took a little bit more time with it. But like, that was just one of those moments where, it's like as a producer, it's like being a proud father. I mean, I just sat there and watched his kids shine. He's not a kid, but I mean, I watched him come into his own and just make something incredible and something that he is so proud of. And there's no fixes, there's no nothing. And it's amazing.
Do you think sometimes we have a tendency to overproduce in the studio when possibly simpler is better?
Oh, yeah. And I'm guilty of it all the time. Well,
I think we all are. Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
let's add a xylophone here.
Yeah, let's add sleigh bells and tambourines and let's double everything.
And I think groups like maybe Steely Dan was a perfect example. Asia, took forever to produce and it was dozens upon dozens of session players. But it's a great embodiment of work. And I know so many audiophiles that's how they test speakers or they test turntables or whatever it is because of that.
Yeah.
But that's kind of not the norm, nor should it be. Because I think after a while, your ears are oversaturated with complexity, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, and you get really used to hearing everything all at once, and that kind of thing happens. Like there's an old documentary, maybe it's Rattle and Hum. Maybe not. Daniel Lanois is talking about recording the Joshua Tree he's going through, it might have been one of those, where they go in and classic albums things. And, he goes in and he puts all this stuff up that they recorded for these songs. And it's like, wow, like there's so much going on. And he says, well, we just recorded everything. And then he said, when I went to mix bass, drums, vocal, and I just found things and he would just turn them up. I'm air fadering, by the way, right now, turning faders up and down. There was such beauty in the simplistic approach to that where instead of like he just turned everything off guitar wise and anything that wasn't a bass, drums, or vocal and just went through all these things. It's like that's such a genius way to do it because I'm sure they spent a year making that record.
Well, and you're capturing everything you can possibly capture.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean you use it all.
Exactly. Yeah. I love the simplest way to the end of the song. It really goes back to one thing that I've really become a fan of since I moved to Nashville. Like I grew up learning how to make pop records. Let's hang 20 mics on the drums and let's, every option possible that we can do these things. And I got to do a couple records out in Memphis at Sam Phillips Recording. One of them I played on and one of them I then produced. the engineer out there, a guy named Matt Rossbang, who is unbelievable, and he came up working at Sun Records. He is a master of the way records used to get made, and he uses that all the time. He did the first Jason Isbell record, and he does all the Margaret Price stuff. And you listen to those things, and they sound incredible. And it's the most simplest, purest form of recording that you can get to. And I try and lean on that approach as much as I can now, because I don't want to, one, I don't want to have to make all the decisions at the end when, you know, if I happen to be mixing the project, which I mix most of the stuff, but I really just love that really simplistic avenue of getting to a finished product that is amazing. Because I think that unless you're doing Wall of Sound, Mutt Lang kind of stuff, the easiest and fewest things that you can get that help the song translate is the best way to go. And it's not distracting ever. Because at the end of the day, the artist has to be able to go out and play that with an acoustic guitar and a vocal and have it translate to people, you know? And that's how I pick songs, is I never want full produced demos. I want to hear acoustic vocal on a phone or whatever they've got, because that way I can just look at it and then my ear starts going off, and I'm not married to the demo guy's guitar lick or whatever it's going to be, you know? I mean,
especially when you get into the studio with the session players on my end, when I'm in there with them, I let them cut loose. I let's build this together. Let's be creative together.
Yeah.
Because those guys might have ideas that you're not hearing either.
Well, yeah. And that's the other side of being a producer, is that you have to know the right guys to call for that kind of thing. And you start to get a Rolodex of, like, if we're going to do something maybe where we want to get a little bit outside of what would be this, you know, the stock thing, I know that I can call this guitar player and this keyboard player, and maybe I'll play drums on it, or maybe I won't, or whatever. It's just, but it's about bringing in, no, and knowing the guys that can help you achieve that goal. That's probably the most valuable lesson I learned, because when I moved here, I didn't have all my guys that I had back home, and I was like, oh, shoot. So I was sending a lot of overdubs back home until I started meeting more people down here. But now it's just, I mean, there's such a plethora of unbelievably talented and creative guys, that guitar players and keyboard players and bass players that live here, that will come at things in a session, and I'm just like, never in a million years would I have thought of that kind of thing. And they really just elevate the track to that next level, and it's pretty inspiring thing.
And you want to rely on that on occasions.
I think you have to, you know. I mean, that's, you can't have every idea. You can't be every man. You can't wear every hat on the project, you know, and do that. Like,
I think as a producer too, you're wearing so many hats as it is.
Yeah.
Along with being a producer, we've talked about this, you know, you're kind of the babysitter and the marriage counselor and, you know, all those things that go along with it. I think that the producer is got to find their own place before they even get with the artist, so they know what they can bring to the table and know their limitations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's got to be determined before you ever set foot in a studio.
Yeah, absolutely.
How can people find you?
You can find me on Facebook, just Jaytook, Jaytooke. I'm on Instagram, which is under same name. And then, or my manager, Chuck, which is probably the easiest way, ThompsonEntertainmentGroup.com. You can hit him up over there. He can answer any and all questions that you have.
Jay, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
The Business Side of Music is the creation of Tom Sabella and Tracy Snow and is produced by Bob Bender. The Business Side of Music is recorded at Music Dog Studios in Los Angeles, California and Nashville, Tennessee. Production sound design by Keith Stark. Voiceover and promo by Lisa Busan.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.